Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Top of the morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Nice. I mean, it's going to be hot this afternoon, but a nice fall morning.
Yeah, I mean, that's
Austin standards.
It's very generous.
Well, you know, it was nice earlier, let's put it that way.
Not to be like the weather thing, but like it's so crazy right now, like how beautiful it is in the shade and how unbearable it is in the sun. Like it's just...
There's something metaphoric about that, I think.
Maybe. I guess so.
So, you know, today we thought that we would circle back, and we haven't really done a whole podcast on the Senate race, although we've, you know, been touching on it as the polling, we've done the periodic poll releases in that race and commented on the evolution of that race. So today we thought we'd take a closer look at the U.S. Senate race in Texas between incumbent Ted Cruz and his challenger, three-term Congressman Colin Allred of Dallas. The candidates will have their only debate on Tuesday, October 15th, which is, you know, for at least some people in Texas, must-see TV. Mm-hmm. And the race more recently has been getting national attention. And I think if you look at the larger context of this, part of it is the national fight over the Senate, where Democrats nationally have a one-seat majority. They're at a disadvantage nationally in that they are defending more seats this cycle than Republicans are, given the staggered nature of Senate re-elections in between, or Senate elections in between censi. And just in the last few weeks, a lot more increased attention to Texas as some of the key Democrats are struggling. I think most people are writing off John Tester in Montana. You know, Sherrod Brown, I think, is running a little stronger in Ohio. But there are, you know, a handful of these Senate seats. You know, people are in trouble and Democrats are beginning to see the writing on the wall. And, you know, as somebody... recently was pointing out in our colleague Sean Theriault yesterday in a thing in the government department, among other people, pointing out that actually Allred looks closer to Cruz in the polls right now than Tester is to his Republican opponent in Montana. And so there's an understandable kind of rational shift to reconsidering what's going on in Texas, what's going on with Senator Rick Scott in Florida. And that's kind of setting this up.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in some ways, you know, one of the things that makes Texas unique, and I mean, again, to your point, you know, one of our other colleagues who we have on the podcast regularly, Darren Shaw, was doing a presentation yesterday as well. And you're looking at sort of the partisan leans of the various states. And the reality is, you know, Texas is not really kind of far outside of the middle. You know, when you kind of look at what we think of as competitive states, the issue with states like Texas and Florida is that, you know, it's no small amount of resources once you decide you want to be competitive. So in some ways, Texas could be more competitive, you know, in terms of like the partisan lean than some other states. And there could still be reticence to spend money here. I think right now what you're seeing is that as Democrats, you know, two things, right? One, as Democrats are writing off states that, you know, essentially, they kind of needed to win, but that would be less expensive to campaign in. But I think on the heels of certainly huge fundraising numbers, especially at the national level, now they're sort of turning this money to where they can, and Texas is one of the recipients, it seems, of that.
Yeah, we're at a familiar point in the cycle where parties are trying to figure out where they're going to place their last couple rounds of bets.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, the worst thing than placing the wrong bets is not placing bets, because I mean, if you want to see people mad, it's when they don't spend the money.
Right.
And so, and that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, what you're seeing is that, you know, as other groups are starting to pay more attention to taxes, I mean, one of the things, you know, having been here for a long time, you know, you kind of go, yeah, you know, $10 million, is, you know, it's a lot of money, but how much is it really? Like,
yeah,
in a state like this, it's kind of like, you're like, yeah, it's, you know.
As people have, you know, pointed out, we're certainly not for, you know, whether it's a million or 10 million, it goes a lot farther in Montana than it does in Texas.
Exactly.
Right. So,
and if anything, it shows the desperation of the of Democrats and their Senate hopes that now they're kind of moving in this direction.
Yeah. The price of doing business here is always, you know, more expensive, you know, is higher.
Right.
Not in all things. I don't want to hear from the governor's office, but comes to politics, certainly the price of doing business here, a lot higher. So, you know, a little, let's delve a little into the background before we look at the current. So, you know, obviously the big benchmark here for better and for worse, and we want to talk about that for a few minutes, is Ted Cruz's last race in 2018, where he narrowly beat Beto O'Rourke, 2.58%. Cruz won by 215,000 votes. And I think, you know, this election is, you know, we talk about interpretation a lot, and that's not quite the right way to describe this, but the level of interpretation that goes on and how people are attaching meaning to this election varies a lot. And, you know, it's a complicated thing to some degree, I think. It's fair to say.
I think that's right. I mean, I get a lot of questions about, you know, whether or not, you know, this race is going to be, you know, competitive, whether Allred can do it, you know, whatever the way the question is formed. And I think one of the things about, you know, Cruz's 2018 race, and I've been thinking about this as sort of discussion question that we can talk about a little bit now, is like, is that really fair? You know, is that really the fair point of comparison? And we'll talk about sort of why, you know, I think Cruz sort of has this fixed space in people's minds, but I'll just put this point out there. Right. In that same election, right, which was a very tough year for Republicans across the board.
And for structural reasons.
For structural reasons. Yeah, yeah.
Not only in Texas, but everywhere.
That's right. I mean, nationally. That was not that was a Democratic year. We don't need to go into the details there. Most of you probably know that. But, you know, while Cruz won his race by 215,000, I think a lot of people sort of automatically say to themselves, well, that's pretty close to zero. You know, right? I mean, you're almost looking past it to say, you know, well, how much further would Democrats need to get? In that same election, again, very different candidate, very different race, but Greg Abbott won by over a million votes. Same election, 2018, same year, same structural factors. Again, different candidates, different, you know, fundraising, all that kind of stuff. But the point is there were a lot more Republican votes out there to pick up, or at least potentially Republican-leaning voters, and Abbott got them, right? And so, you know, and you can sort of look at all the races since then that are top of the ticket races. So again, that same year, Abbott won by 1.1 million. You go ahead to 2020, you know, we kind of come to this, but Trump won by 630,000 votes, so another 400,000 votes on top of what, you know, Cruz did. Cornyn won by over a million. Abbott won in 22 by 880,000 votes. So this is all just to say, yes, 215,000 is close to zero. Right, in terms of
closer than 600,000, objectively speaking.
Right, yeah. But there's no indication that those voters exist yet, and that's just the point I'm making. Is when you look at the whole scope of the elections that we've seen, you know, I'd say that, you know, yeah, maybe Cruz underperformed, but underperformed means that there's somewhere to go.
Yeah, and to the point that there was a lot going on that year, you know, the attorney general and lieutenant governor's races were pretty close that year too. You know. Compared to the usual baseline.
Right, compared to the usual baseline.
Right, and compared to where, you know, how well Abbott did. You know, there's probably a little side point there. You know, candidates matter.
Yeah,
right?
Candidates.
In that, you know, Governor Abbott had an unusually weak candidate opponent that year. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Attorney General's race, Attorney General Paxton, even back then, mm-hmm. had some issues that, you know, probably weakened some level, you know, his support at some level. You know, had a savvy candidate if untested at the time in Justin Nelson, mm-hmm. And I think somebody, you know, who ran an unusually strong race at that level of the ballot for the Democrats.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were things going on there. You know, I think one of the funny things that's hard to kind of reason through on this, you know, is the conviction out there, and it's stronger among Democrats, but, you know, I've also had a lot of, you know, reporters, other people kind of start the conversation. Well, you know, everybody kind of hates Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
You know, he's very unpopular. And
it's remarkable how many conversations with people who should know better start that
really
way.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's interesting. And, you know, he's unpopular, he's unlikable, therefore he's vulnerable.
Right.
And look, that's true of Democrats, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in our most recent polling, you know, 82% of Democrats had an unfavorable view of Cruz, 73% very unfavorable, 80% disapprove of the job he's doing, 71% strongly. And that's pretty common. But this is the thing. It's not just, you know, it's not just the direction. it's the intensity, but this is really like a Democratic thing.
Yeah, and look, there's not absolutely nothing there. If you look at the trajectory of Cruz's career, you know, there has been, you know, there have been interesting phases to Ted Cruz's
absolutely.
Career. And, you know, it seems like a long time ago, but, you know, when you think back to when Ted Cruz won the nomination in 2012 out of a very crowded field, you know, he was rightly seen as a sign of, you know, the ascendance of the Tea Party wave within the Texas GOP and in the state overall. You know, he defeated Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst.
Well-funded.
Well-funded, and in many ways, you know, was, you know, ran as kind of a known quantity and a quasi-incumbent, you know, and I think that, you know, it was a sign of two, you know, Cruz's rise was, you know, the sign of, you know, the ascendancy, as I've said, of this Tea Party. But it was also, you know, exposed, you know, was the first phase of exposing David Dewhurst as, you know, not a particularly strong candidate and somebody who had had kind of a glide path in. And once it got hard, actually turned out to not, not run very well. And, you know, that was the other shoe dropping on that was when Dewhurst lost that Senate primary. He ran in 2014 again and was, to be reelected Lieutenant Governor, and then lost in that primary to none other than Dan Patrick.
Right.
You know, talking about the other shoe kind of dropping in terms of this internal shift inside the Texas GOP.
He has an interesting footnote for
his history. Dewhurst, you know, a role in the ascension of probably the two most prominent figures of that came out of the Tea Party shift in the GOP. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then, you know, he's and Cruz ran with that. And again, we were talking about 2018 and what the mood of that moment was. You know, when Ted Cruz goes to the Senate in 2013, Obama's second term, you know, he establishes an image that he is now, you know, to jump ahead, obviously trying to dilute a little bit or you know, rebrand
Sand
to some degree,
or
at least with the broader niche in the electorate. I mean, you know, his initial approach to being a setter was to be disruptive, was to be an outsider. And, you know, I think he didn't, I think he actually built on the whole, you know, nobody likes Ted Cruz thing, because the argument was, because I'm not one of them.
Yeah, I think the term of art, you know, to my mind at the time, or the word that sticks with me was, you know, insurgent.
You know,
this idea that there was an insurgency. And one of the notable things about an insurgent is that, you know, you're not there to work with the government.
Right. And there were, you know, at the time there were, you know, I use this term and I try not to use it, but sometimes it just fits. You know, there was some PAC journalism that went on at the time.
Yeah.
There were a million stories about how his new colleagues kind of hated him and he didn't mind. You know, and that included no small number of Republicans at the time because, you know, he was so dedicated to being a bomb thrower and a disruptor. And that was his brand.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm reinforcing your point here. And I think I'm both kicking the press and giving them a pass. Or I don't even know here, but it's also like, he had no problem with that. I mean, I'd say, like, I don't think at that point in time, the PAC journalism that showed Cruz as being an outsider was a problem for him either, right? I mean,
I think they enjoyed the, you know, the hook of, you know, I mean,
everybody
I kind
hates
of vaguely
him,
remember a headline like, you know, nobody likes Ted Cruz or something.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this reminds me a little bit more even, I mean, even of the time, because when this started, it's funny, it wasn't that long ago, and yet it feels so long ago in certain ways, right? And like, this was the time when, you know, you might have said, I mean, I'm going to take this from you, it's like, oh, so the New York Times is writing that nobody likes you as a senator from Texas. Like, you're like, great, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's really tough for you.
Yeah.
You're really showing him, New York Times.
Yeah, and again, now, obviously, you know, fast forward ahead, and this year's in the media is so much fragmented. It's so a different environment, but at that point in time, you'd almost take them and say, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, thanks for that.
Right. And so if we follow his trajectory, and we've got a really, you know, kind of telling, you know, a really good, useful, if, you know, kind of monstrous graphic that looks at Cruz's favorability ratings and his job approval ratings, you know, over a long period of time. And, you know, that worked for him among Republican voters, given where the Republican Party was, Republican voters in Texas, given where the party was at the time and where it was headed.
Yeah, I mean, he enters, you know, office essentially, you know, at about a little under 70% favorability rating among Republican voters, and then just climbs up to about 80% over the course of the next couple years, really, in a lot of ways, only to be dented by his own decision to run for president in 2016 and stay in.
Right. And there's a certain, you know, this is not entirely fair, but, you know, you're you're about 75% of being able to say, you know, hoist upon your own petard here.
Yeah.
Because then Donald Trump comes as, you know, look, we've what are the terms we've used, you know, for Ted Cruz? Insurgent.
Right.
You know, bomb thrower. You know, and you know, then he challenged, you know, he winds up challenging Donald, meeting Donald Trump in the 2016 primary. And it's one of the periods where you see his favorability numbers in Texas dip because of the way that the 2016 primary pulls out, you know, plays out, not just the negative attacks by Trump on Cruz, mm-hmm. but also Cruz not giving in early.
Yeah.
And, you know, dragging his feet and accepting Trump as the nominee at the convention. And, you know, the dip in his job approval ratings and his favorability ratings among both Republican overall in Texas and among Republicans right. is very clear during that period.
Yeah, I mean, again, he was as high in June of 2014, he was as high as 80% favorable ratings among Republicans. And by June of 2016, kind of in the middle of this, he went down to 55%.
Right. But his numbers then, you know, he takes another little dip during, you know, the unfortunate vacation choice during Winter Storm Uri. But he's recovered more or less since then. He's not come back to his previous heights, but he's still...
He's pretty close, though.
Pretty close, though, in the high 70s.
Yeah, he's in the high
70s. Mid to high 70s, consistent among Republicans.
Among Republicans, and that's right. And you know, and the thing is, you know, being, you know, so a couple things. One, I mean, just to add to that primary piece, I mean, one of the sort of shocking things about the 2016 primaries was that anybody was going to outflank Cruz on immigration, and Trump did that. So in addition to sort of, I think, you know, the fact that he was dealing with all the negative barbs from Trump, he also wasn't able to distinguish himself in the way that he really probably had a strength, which was on the sort of singular issue of immigration, which Trump basically took. And I
right.
mean, so a lot of things going on there. I mean, how did he end up recovering from all this? Well, one, you know, he basically made up, right, with Trump. And then ultimately he became one of his, you know, big defenders, both, you know, in terms of the election, but also during the impeachment, really notably in a way that's kind of come back around in this campaign in a bunch of interesting ways with his podcast where he was doing these sort of nightly podcasts during the impeachment. And then has continued on with these in a way that's given him a really direct line to a lot of his most committed supporters.
Yeah, and it's been, it was a smart move. It's worked for him.
Yeah.
Not rocket science, but still.
Says us.
You know, yeah, but, you know, yes, yeah. as we, you know, yeah. Yeah, start a podcast.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, you know, it proved helpful for him. And, you know, as we look at his favorability, and particularly his job approval numbers, you know, he's been, you know, skirting, I think, in kind of net positive territory overall.
Yeah, which, I mean, again, in Texas,
it's, you know,
that's
kind of a achievement for somebody where, you know, and kind of, you know, moves against the Democratic argument that everybody hates.
Well, that's
him.
The thing. That's where it really flies in the
that's
face.
That's kind of where you land this plane.
Yeah, that's where you fly in the face of this whole idea that, like, you know, everybody hates Ted Cruz, but his job approval numbers look pretty okay for anybody in a competitive state. It's like, well, then I guess that's not true. Right.
So then we look at Colin Allred, right? And Colin Allred, you know, very different story in the sense of, you know, a much more recent entrant and still entering into Texas, the mental real estate and political awareness of Texans.
Right.
And that's really, to my mind, the big part of the Allred story up to Labor Day.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at, you know, if we look at our polling, you know, in August of last year, 64% of voters couldn't offer an impression of Allred either way, favorable, unfavorable, you know, anything. And that's been cut in half by August of this year. It's down to 32%, right? And so that's the work of campaigning. This is the expense of Texas. You know, this is the difficulty. Now, what is that made up of? It's a mix, right? It's a lot of Democrats sort of learning who he is and most likely forming positive opinions of him. And it's also Republicans forming negative opinions of him because that's what the campaigns, you know, are about. But ultimately, this has been, you know, I mean, this is sort of the difficulty, I mean, I think, for Democrats always is that, you know, somebody jumps in the race, they look like an okay candidate, and then everybody complains that they're not doing enough, you know, for months and months and months and months. And, you know, honestly, this is the stuff that actually these candidates need to do, is they need to show up and, you know, at the college campuses. They need to go to the Democratic clubs. They need to do the kind of stuff that essentially...
It doesn't move the big public needle.
No, it doesn't move the big public. And I think part of this, Jimmy, this goes back, I mean, we're not, you know, this kind of goes back to the O'Rourke thing. I mean, and again, it goes back to people's expectations. It's like, you know, if you're waiting for Colin Allred to, you know, do an ollie on a skateboard in the Whataburger parking lot, like, you know, you're probably going to have to keep waiting, right? Like, that's just not something that most candidates can do. That was one of the things, I mean, of all the things that I think O'Rourke unfairly gets credit for. He does fairly get credit for creating his own media moments, you know, based on his instincts, I think, during that campaign in a way that I think really worked for him. But that's not normal, right? You know, most people just need to grind it out, right?
Yeah, use Ollie and grind. In the
you
same.
Like that?
Yeah. Look at this. You grew up in New York.
I grew up in New York, man.
And I meant that as a guy that, you know, where skateboarding was invented in California, really, I think.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I digress. I think that, you know, the story of, you know, kind of watching Allred and watching, you know, this contrast with 2018 and O'Rourke, you know, it also raises this issue of, you know, the big perpetual Democratic dilemma and the decision that Allred made with the support of national Democrats in terms of this perpetual question, do you run to the left or do you run to the center left? Or, you know, even if, you know, the Allred campaign probably doesn't even want to call it the center left.
Yeah, I don't think. Want to call that.
But, you know, they made clearly an early commitment to a certain strategy here, which I would summarize as, you know, I am progressive enough, but basically moderate.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've stuck to that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard not to look at this and assume that part of this is, you know, learning, like, you know, a reaction to prior campaigns. Because, I mean, there's one thing that you kind of know. I mean, if you go into the election, whether it's in Texas or somewhere else, you know, the Republican messaging as it relates to the Democratic candidate is that this candidate is the most liberal person you've ever seen in your life. And we kind of joked about this before. It really doesn't matter who the candidate is, right? I mean, it could be Bill White. It could be Barack Obama. It could be Beto O'Rourke, right? It doesn't make a difference. This is the most liberal candidate you've ever seen, you know, on the face of the earth.
Right.
And so I think in some ways, you know, Democrats always have a hard time with, you know, it's like, well, and I think this is tough within the party and within, this is partially also within the financial universe of the party, right? You know, do you embrace this idea that, you know, well, Texas is really this progressive place. We just need to like excite those progressive voters to turn out. And so therefore, if we give them this vision, they'll show up even though they never have. Right. And the flip side is, well, if we know what their strategy is and we walk into that strategy, how's it worked out for us so far? And the answer is not very well. And so you are seeing a movement here. I mean, I think, you know, you're seeing this reflected at the national level a little bit, too. I mean, I, you know, this is one of those, I don't really know how much of this is local versus national. And I'm thinking about the immigration issue here in particular, because you're seeing national Democrats really moderate's an interesting word there. I'm not sure if that's even right. But let's just say take more aggressive stances on immigration policy than they have in the past. And I mean, we talked about this in this podcast, so that's clearly a reflection of, you know, I think something that's going on in the electorate. It's going on with Democratic voters. And clearly, if it's going on with Democratic voters, like in Ohio, it's going on here even more so. And so I think Allred was really quick to jump on that. But it is one of those things where, you know, until Democrats win an election, you're just like, well, we'll see how this works.
So how is this all shaking out? I mean, look, what we're seeing now in the most recent polling is this race, you know, tightening. It's been, you know, we had the race at 8 among registered voters in the last week of August. And I think, you know, I haven't looked directly at the timing of all the ad buys, but my sense is, you know, the Allred ad buys in the state were beginning to increase and then really ramped up after that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, probably was ramping up as we were in the field in the last, you know, 10 days in August, 10 days in August. And during and after Labor Day, it's just cranked up as I've been going around doing talks in different parts of the state. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my audience participation, you know, trick has been, okay, you can admit it, no judgment. Raise your hand if you watch cable news or, you know, any kind of network news and, you know, people kind of reluctantly have to go, no one's going to shame you. You can admit it. And, you know, in the trade groups I've been talking to, you know, it's slightly old, you know, median age is probably older than like the talk in the government department yesterday, the panel in the government department yesterday. And you get a lot of people raising their hands. I say, okay, keep your hand up if you've seen a Colin Allred ad.
Right.
Right. I had a couple of people like raise their hand, you know, raise their other hand up because they've seen so many. Now, the Cruz campaign is also cranking up their advertising and you get that back. But I mean, you know, at this point, the purposes of that original, certainly that initial round of intro ads by the Allred campaign.
Yeah.
You know, the one that had them there with, I think we talked, it came up last week or the week before with, you know, uniform law enforcement and, you know, the message on the screen saying, you know, I've, you know, with the voiceover, I vote against the president when I think he's wrong, you know, kind of thing, you know, has been going on. You know, as you said, he's got a very well-funded campaign. They're not lacking money right now.
Right.
And, you know, it's almost certainly moved the needle, right, in terms of what we saw in terms of the number of uncommitted Democratic voters that we saw in the last week of August.
And I think that's really the fundamental and key point to understand here, right, is that that's right. Is like, this has moved the needle in particular among Democratic voters, right? There's no indication in any of the polling that we've done, you know, on this race over the last year that you see
Republicans going, you know what? I hate Ted Cruz. I'm going to vote for Colin Allred.
Yeah. Sorry. That's nowhere in the data. Again, Republicans are very happy with Ted Cruz. They're very likely to support him. And, you know, what this race looks like, and honestly, this is what most, you know, national elections, it's a mobilization game, right? Republicans can turn out their voters. They're very likely to win the election because, you know, on both, you know, again, both levels, because that's what they've done in the past. They've shown that they have enough voters and that they have the ability to turn them out at a rate that Democrats are unable to at this point, right? So,
but Democrats are now pouring a lot of resources into this, and we'll see, you know, if pouring those resources in addition to the advertising also, you know, creates more ground game.
Yeah. And I think this is where the tricky part is it, you know, it's easy to look at the polling data and to draw a line, you know, through Allred's support and say, well, clearly he's got, you know, quote unquote momentum, which is in and of itself a complicated idea. But the idea here is that something is happening, the race is like sort of shifting in his direction. And that's the way the language works too, right? I mean, when the Cook Political Report shifts its designation of the race from, you know, likely Republican to lean Republican, people innately say, oh, this is moving in Allred's direction, or, oh, this is slipping away from Cruz. But again, I'm just going to like caution against that interpretation at this point, only because what we're really seeing is we're seeing the Democratic voters who have not been paying attention to this for a year and a half, who are now starting to see ads all the time, who are now, you know, getting mailers, the block walking is going on. They're saying, oh, yeah, and we like to, you know, the way we joke about this or talk about this, you get reminded why you're a Democrat. You get reminded why you're a Republican. And then, you know, this kind of gets us back into what we're looking at here, which is, you know, the spread when we look at all the polling that we've seen, especially in the last month, which you're kind of getting to, is, you know, Cruz leading by somewhere, you know, except for one outlier poll, Cruz leading by somewhere between 2 and 5 points.
Right. But I think the data point we want to look at, too, I want to add to that is, you know, as of our August poll, in the trial ballot, there were about 20% of Democrats were uncommitted.
Right.
Either said, haven't made up my mind, or someone else.
Yeah.
And when we looked at the favorability rating of Allred, even a little higher than that, I think it was about 24% or so, were in those two kind of, you know, either I'm neutral or I don't know.
Right.
And so there is some share of people, and I think we said in the poll release, you know, at that time, you could call that, you know, you could argue that either way for Colin Allred.
Yeah.
A, he's got room to grow.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing is more, you know, there's more room to grow.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, they've still got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Right. Or, you know, the two, not even or, and they've still got a lot of work to do if they're going to close it. Well, it does seem to me that they're doing the work and they're spending the money. To your point, I guess I would say, you know, there's another dynamic that I would layer on top of your, you know, the talk about this being a mobilization election. And I think, you know, it is going to, of course, all elections are mobilization elections to some degree, particularly now in a more ideologically sorted, polarized, blah, blah, blah. But there's another interesting thing going on here that goes back to the arc of Cruz's trajectory, which is, if you look at recent elections, I mean, sure, statewide Republican candidates have aired a mixture of red meat, more targeted to the Republican base mobilization ads, coupled with negative advertising against whoever the opponent was, you know, thinking about, you know, the Greg Abbott immigration-based
the
ads,
murders,
things like that. And with a little bit of more business development, you know, more what you might think of as a more mainstream appeal. One of the things that's very interesting about this campaign to me is that the candidate-based ads, not the attack, you know, bracket off the attack ads, which are something different, but the candidate-based ads in both campaigns are both moving toward the middle.
Yeah.
And that is a little bit different, right? I mean, we've expected Democrats to have to move closer to the middle because they have to make up for the deficit right. that you're talking about. But I think the interesting factor here is it's been a while since I've seen an election in Texas where there's where the gravity of the middle is quite as powerful as it seems right now in this Senate campaign. And I think one of the keys to that is looking at the uncommitted voters and looking at independents.
Yeah.
It's one of those cases where, you know, if you listen to this podcast regularly, A, you might need help, I don't know. But B, you know, you've heard this before, you know, for the first 10 or 15 years that I was involved in, you could safely ignore independents.
Yeah.
And campaigns, I think, safely, you know, particularly Republican campaigns, ignored independents and moderates. Mm-hmm. If you look at the numbers among independents and moderates, and they're not the same thing, but starting with independents, Allred is running stronger among independents. Now, again, 9% or 8 or 9%, I think, of our last sample, usually not more than 11 to 14%. Not a big share, you know, a group that we expect to break disproportionately among true independents in a Republican direction. And it's not looking like that in the Cruz Allred race. Now, that's going to move around because they're independents.
Right.
But, I mean, that is another interesting factor in terms of our kind of like, look, this is a mobilization election. There is a little something else going on out there that, I mean, I think you've pointed out in terms of, you know, Republican efforts in the Valley, which are part PRs. You know, I think you were talking about this on the podcast a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I agree with that. But also part, you know, trying to carve out little, you know, a little more attention to finer slivers of the electorate than we were seeing 10 or 12 years ago. And I think we're seeing that in really stark terms in this Allred Cruz race. And it speaks to, you know, the part of the Cruz trajectory that we didn't mention, which is, you know, the clearly calculated effort by the Cruz campaign that started a year and a half ago. Yeah. If you go back and see the earliest stories, clearly being encouraged by the Cruz campaign about how Ted Cruz now, like, loves to work with Democrats.
Yeah. He's really more bipartisan than you now.
Yeah. And I think that's another interesting overlay to our assumption about, you know, the mobilization part of the election, which, again, is the predominant part of this.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of the hangovers from 2018, if you're in the Cruz campaign. Hey, you know, maybe we need to pay a little bit more attention to these smaller chunks of voters. And it speaks to the larger discussion that you've been doing all this county level research yeah. on in terms of what's going on in Texas in terms of partisanship.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, the way you set that up is interesting. And it is kind of in some ways both things. I mean, what's interesting is that the way that Texas's increasing competitiveness is manifesting itself, right? And part of it is that we spend most of these podcasts talking about the role of the Republican primary in sort of setting the agenda of the politics of the state. And, you know, we have this interesting system, right, where that happens, right? Then we have these elections, and then we have all the governing takes place, right, during the legislature. Then we have a break, and then this process plays out again. And what's interesting is, you know, nothing has really changed in the Republican primary to sort of moderate the image or decisions of any sort of Republican statewide officials.
If anything, the other direction.
Exactly. If anything, it's actually moved in the other direction. It's actually getting harder, you know, essentially to take even anything approaching a moderate position on anything, right, and then still survive a Republican primary. But that's taking place at the same time as the state is becoming more competitive, right? And so that's sort of, you know, I think what's interesting is that, you know, to your point, if anything, I always love to say, I say this on this podcast sometimes, and I think this is true. It's like, I like to watch the campaign's behavior as a way to sort of learn from their behaviors the way that they view the electorate, right? So when you're watching both Allred sort of tacked to the middle, I mean, it's an acknowledgement by Allred, look, you know, Democrats can't just turn out quote-unquote liberals in Texas. Like, Texas is not some liberal utopia. It's not the next California. Like, that's just not going to fly here. We have plenty of data. Like, you know.
Yeah.
But for Cruz to then also actually make the same calculation in some ways that, you know, hey, the guy that he has been for most of his career really, you know, aggressively, probably not the guy.
Not as workable as it was 10 years ago.
Not as workable as it was 10 years ago. And then to your point, there's, you know, some of this data that kind of flows out there. And I think it speaks to a lot of the what's going on right now. We would look at, you know, efforts by Republican state officials to tamp down registration efforts in some of these big counties. I mean, one of the things when I look at sort of the data that exists is I have to kind of imagine that if you're a a campaign professional right now looking at statewide results, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And this is not to say I don't think Republicans are still in the comfortable position. I mean, I still think that they've got a very good chance of winning it both at the top. But you look at the numbers and it just sort of says why they're nervous, right?
Yeah.
And so just a couple of these numbers, you know, just to give an example, if we just look overall, you know, if we look at, I'm just using 2012 as a baseline, right? So 2012 versus 2020, looking at these presidential races, and we look at the change in votes. You know, overall, between those two elections, Republicans gained about 1.3 million total votes between 2012 and 2020. Democrats have gained 1.95 million, so about 650,000 additional votes. Where did those votes come from? Mostly from the big six, the big six counties. Republicans gained 300,000 votes in those counties. Democrats gained about 1.1 million votes in those counties. In the suburbs, Republicans have gained a little over 500,000. Democrats have gained over a little over 625,000. The only place where Republicans went out on this is in the rural parts of the state, where they've actually increased their vote in total by about 300,000 to about only 48,000 for Democrats. So this is to say, just in and of itself, you say, like, okay, well, you can see, you know, these are sort of the big picture. It's getting more competitive. This is what it looks like, right? And then we've talked about this a couple times. This blows people away sometimes. I bring this up. I say, you know, in Harris County, where all this focus is and where a lot of the registrations are taking place just generally because of its contribution to the state population, Mitt Romney lost that county by 971 votes, which I think blows people's minds when you say it. Trump lost it by 162,000 votes in 2016 and by 217,000 votes in 2020. When we look at the other big counties, we don't have to go through all of them. But this pattern repeats itself. And so I think when you're saying, like, oh, you know, why the sudden interest in what Bexar County is doing to register people or what Travis County, this is what it is, because I think in some ways, if you look at these same trend lines that we're looking at here, I actually think these are somewhat more meaningful in a lot of ways than the polling trend lines, because I think of everything we've talked about, this is where the uncertainty actually comes from. It's, you know, what is turnout going to look like in Texas, but also what's it going to look like in Harris, Bexar, Travis, Dallas, and Tarrant counties? Yeah. What's that vote split going to look like? And for Republicans, you know, to the extent that they are investing money in South Texas, really what they're investing money is in rural parts. I mean, this is, again, this is trying to maximize their share of the rural vote. And I think the other thing that I just sort of, you know, putting together the various pieces and strands that are sort of coming together and sort of thinking about politics over the last few weeks, it also is hard not to think about the role that state-level organizing is going to have in all of this. I mean, one of the interesting things going into this election is the extent to which the Republican Party organization in the state is in a much weaker position than it has historically been in. And that really is an impact. That has an impact down ballot. I mean, that's where, you know, in terms of giving money to the county parties, giving money to local candidates, you expect the state party to kind of have a role in that. And right now, the state party is a little bit in, I'm going to say a little bit in disarray still. And from what you can tell, there's a lot of complaints coming from Republican county chairs about sort of the money that's coming out.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things that's been interesting in looking at some of the campaign finance reporting that's come out of this and looking at some of the data, and, you know, we need to probably dig some of this out, I think, over time, which is that you're seeing a lot of people this cycle giving money directly to the county parties and bypassing the state party.
Right.
And you know, look, I don't want to pick on the Republicans solely, but, you know, it's not like the Democratic Party apparatus is not subject to a lot of criticism and a lot of dissatisfaction among Democrats. You know, not all of that. You know, I think if anything, because of the sharp ideological tenor of the split in the Republican Party and the way that, you know, the Republican Party of Texas as an organization has become kind of another quasi-organization on the far right in the Republican universe, we're hearing more about that. And people are just more used to the state Democratic Party being, you know, underfunded and ineffectual.
But I think that's what's interesting about this moment. Again, I don't think it's really going to matter. But I mean, going back and then looking forward, I mean, going back, you know, the not to be like, oh, the political science. But I mean, when the political science looks at sort of, you know, the Republican sort of reascendance in the South, a lot of, you know, that also looks at the role of party organizations and the professionalization of Republican county party organizations and the important role that that played in the party. And as, and then right now, you know, you kind of look at, again, just this moment where we are, and I see, you know, and it's hard for me not to look at that story and look at sort of the, you know, probably $10 million plus that Democrats are looking to throw into Texas right now, and the million that, you know, Republicans are advertising spending in South Texas. And to some extent, it's sort of, it's odd. I mean, to your point, you know, it's odd to see Republicans tacking to the middle, you know, in a general election the way that we're seeing. It's also odd to sort of even be talking about the Republican Party organization as somehow underfunded or unprepared or, you know, less than, because we're so used to doing that with the Democrats here.
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, I mean, it's not like Republicans are lacking money the state. It's just that the channels for that money are different. And, you know, we're not even touching on, you know, the politics and the political economy of the campaign consultant class.
Yeah.
And that layer. And, you know, and it's, you know, political science. I mean, we know that there has been a shift towards these campaign organizations, towards consultants, towards, you know, and that is a huge center of gravity. But that competition is also subject to the cleavages within the party, and that we're seeing in the Republican Party as well. I think we stumbled upon a good topic for another time
to
talk about this some more. But so to wind this up, I mean, you know, I think we've hit a lot of the things we kind of wanted to hit on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the natural thing would be for people to say, hey, how about a prediction? Having been, you know, dinged by my colleague Brian Jones as part of the collective judgment yesterday in that government department panel for, you know, being too locked up in predictions and not being institutional enough. But I, you know, and I don't want to make a prediction in this race, but I do think that, you know, this, I will be interested, obviously, in seeing our next set of polling when we switch to our likely voter model. And when you know, because the timing is now appropriate. And we start seeing more, you know, I don't have any doubt the trend line is so clear. And I'll be shocked if we don't see, you know, the number of undecideds or the people that seem like they haven't made a judgment call about Colin Allred, you know, not, you know, go down pretty significantly in our next poll.
Yeah.
And what that's going to look like as other people begin to make up their mind a little bit more, and we'll probably do a force in this poll and all this kind of thing. So, but, you know, I think it's fair to feel like this race probably is in single digits as of now. And I think one of the things I've been, you know, because we're talking about resources, you know, it's hard not to think back, you know, again to 2018. When there was a coordinated last-minute push to turn out Republican voters on Election Day based on Republican concerns about where the early voting turnout was high, you know, that weekend between the end of early voting and the Tuesday of in-person voting.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I don't know what it's going to look like because early voting hasn't started, but I think you have to, you know, you have to expect that Republicans, because of the fundraising advantage, the experience, the advantage of incumbencies, the advantages of incumbency, that we will see another last-minute push like that that is well-coordinated and well-funded. But, to, you know, to the earlier discussion, the vehicle for that in 2018 was not mainly the parties. It was the campaigns of the statewide. I'm sure there was coordination with the statewide party. But, you know, the impetus for that came from decisions made among the statewide candidates with the governor in the lead.
Yeah.
And his campaign in the lead.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, to the extent that we haven't had like a podcast just directly on this Senate race, even though it, like, this has actually generated a lot of attention, and you know, in some ways, I can't help but sort of look at it almost from my own perspective. It's like, why haven't we talked about this, you know, yet?
And we have. We just haven't dedicated a whole podcast.
No, that's what I mean, though. But just dedicate the whole time to it. And I think, you know, to some extent, you know, waiting for the race to mature and kind of see what happens. I think, you know, there's that piece of it. But you know what I think is also interesting is that, you know, the fact that it's not super interesting. I mean, it is, right? This is an interesting race, and it's interesting over the horizon and the time period. But in some ways, if Cruz ends up winning this race by, you know, let's say 3 to 6 points, somewhere between where he won last time and where Trump won last time, let's just say, right? You know, Democrats will be disappointed. Cruz will be fine with it. You know, he doesn't care, right? He'll win. He'll move on. He'll have done better than he did last time. But clearly, it's another dot on the trend line. Right. Yeah. And it's another thing where you say, what's a normal Texas election look like? And I mean, it just wasn't that long ago that we were looking at 20-point gaps.
Right. And you know, I mean, to the point of Democrats being disappointed, a lot of Democrats will be very disappointed. But I also think a lot of Democrats are already talking about 2026 and jumping in the statewide races in 2026. And, you know, if we stay on the trend line or even stable from the last couple of cycles, you know, we are going to see very crowded primaries. in both sides in 2026. And I apologize to everybody for raising 2026 already. But, you know, I think, you know, if this all shakes out the way it looks right now, mm-hmm. and we see low to medium single digit wins by Republicans at the presidential and the Senate level, and, you know, more or less stasis in the legislature, you know, buckle up for 2026. That would be my view. So with that, thanks for being here today, Josh. As always, thanks to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. All this data and much, much more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.